You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
Oh, I don't think 50 days is very long.
The lives of our clients are literally at risk because of this data breach.
I follow a whole lot of pain
that video. He does. Frankly, I have to say that some of this is starting to look a little bit indulgent.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stewart and joining me is Claudia Farhat. Just another quiet week in the world of news.
Yes, we will be zipping right around the globe this week, Kat. The talks for a truce in Gaza have stalled once again, but US President Donald Trump is ramping up the pressure on Russia, giving them a 50-day deadline to end the war in Ukraine.
Yep, and while things may have quietened on the ceasefire front in Gaza, a new wave of sectarian violence is gripping Syria, with Israel also getting involved.
Plus, when pandas meet politics, Anthony Albanese wraps up his six-day tour of China. Our chief political correspondent, Anna Henderson, has been travelling with the PM the whole way, and she'll be joining us a little later for her key takeaways from the trip.
Can't wait, and be sure to stick around till the end for the African leader who's attempting to break an age-old record. It's really quite something.
It's not my war. I'm trying to get you out of it. And we want to see it end. And I'm disappointed in President Putin because I thought we would have had a deal 2 months ago, but it doesn't seem to get there.
Donald Trump there expressing his frustrations over the ongoing war in Ukraine. This week, the US president has certainly changed his tune on the conflict, ramping up pressure on Putin by giving him a 50-day deadline to come to a deal to end the war and threatening Russia with secondary tariffs of 100% if he doesn't. At the same time, the US and NATO have reached a new agreement for a huge delivery of weapons to Ukraine, including Patriot air defence missiles, which Trump said have already been shipped.
There's since been some confusion about how exactly this weapons deal will work. Initially, it seemed as though the US would supply the weapons and NATO countries would pay for them. Trump later said, though, that some of the weapons will have to come from NATO stockpiles and then the US will sell them replacements. Trump also ruled out supplying Kyiv with any long-range missiles, which would also be able to strike targets deep inside Russia, and denied reports that he encouraged Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to strike Moscow. To help us make sense of it all, we are joined now by our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis. Thanks so much for coming back on the pod, Ben.
Happy to be here. Thanks, guys.
To start off, Ben, can you talk us through this 50-day deadline that Trump's given? He's set targets to end the war before. Originally, he said he'd do it on the first day of his presidency. He couldn't get that done. So how seriously should we be taking this new deadline?
Yeah, Trump loves a deadline, doesn't he? So there was that 24 hours after taking office. Obviously, that was never going to happen. He's famously sets a deadline for 2 weeks when he doesn't want to put an actual time on something. So we've heard this several times before during his either first term of his presidency and now in the second term, particularly in relation to Vladimir Putin. He has 2 weeks. 2 weeks comes around, nothing ever happens. This time does feel a little bit different. I'm not sure if I can say this on the pod, so you can bleep it out if you need to. It sounds like he's pretty pissed off with Vladimir Putin. Now, it's hard to say if this is because Putin has been doing these horrendous strikes on Ukrainian civilian areas over the last few weeks, or if it's simply that he has made Donald Trump look silly in the eyes of the rest of the world. So the 50-day deadline may be relatively serious this time. You would expect that Russia will try and extend it somehow, say it's agreed to more negotiations, whatever the case might be. But there are a lot of people, even in Donald Trump's own party, particularly in the Senate, who want him to stick to this deadline and show a little bit of toughness, saying that the only thing Vladimir Putin is going to respect is when people get tough with him.
And as you just mentioned, Trump loves a deadline, and it's not the first time we've heard him threaten one. But is this tougher stance likely to make a difference in actually ending the war?
Look, I think it's probably more about keeping Ukraine in the fight at this stage. I mean, the tougher stance, these threats of tariffs and then secondary sanctions, yeah, they would have a big impact on Russia's economy, particularly secondary sanctions on trading partners like China and India that the shipments of new weapons to Ukraine are vital for them to slow that Russian summer offensive, which is grinding on in the east of the country. So it's probably not going to help end the war, given that Vladimir Putin has shown absolutely no interest in an actual ceasefire, but it will probably help Ukraine sort of turn the tide, given that the momentum has been with Russia over the last couple of months.
Ben, we also wanted to chat with you about the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte. A couple of weeks ago, we heard him calling Donald Trump daddy, and well, this week it looks like he and other European leaders once again are really leaning into the charm offensive when it comes to dealing with the US president.
Yeah, you could feel the collective cringe of NATO leaders when Mark Rutte said daddy in front of Donald Trump. Horrendous, isn't it? But it seems to work. Mark Rutte is very good at this. Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, has become particularly good at this. It's, you called it a sort of a charm offensive. It's sucking up to Donald Trump, basically. That's all it is. And we saw it in the Oval Office the other day. Mark Rutte announcing this plan where, let's be honest here, Europe is paying for all of these weapons. The United States is going to make a profit by selling them. But Mark Rutte was lavishing Donald Trump with praise. You know, you knew this was a good idea. You knew you had to take tougher action against Putin. And Donald Trump sitting there with a big smile on his face, like the cat that got the cream. It does seem to be working. Mark Rutte's also been very good when it comes to NATO funding. He has repeatedly said, President Trump, European allies were not paying their fair share, and now they are, thanks to you. Now, the truth is, a lot of European NATO members have said they're going to increase their military spending. Very few have actually done it yet, but it's a strategy that seems to work. It keeps Donald Trump on side. Remember, in his first term, we were asking if America was going to leave NATO. No one's talking about that anymore.
Thanks so much for talking us through it all once again, Ben.
Pleasure, guys.
The Secretary General is also concerned by Israel's airstrikes on Syrian territory and calls on Israel to refrain from violations of Syria's independence.
So the talks to reach another ceasefire and hostage deal in Gaza that we were chatting about on the pod last week seem to have stalled yet again. Mm-hmm. But we do have some other updates out of the Middle East for you this week. We'll start off in Syria, where dozens of people have been killed in a new wave of sectarian violence. This has all been happening in and around Soweida, which is a Druze majority city in the south. The Druze are a religious minority group who practice an offshoot of Islam, but many do not identify themselves as Muslim. The violence began with tit-for-tat kidnappings and attacks between local Bedouin tribes and armed Druze factions, which then escalated into armed clashes on the weekend. Convoys of Syrian army tanks then entered the city. The interim government said they were sending in troops to end the violence and restore order, but they were then quickly targeted by Israeli airstrikes, which Israel described as a warning to government forces not to harm the Druze community. Let's pause there, Claudia. This isn't the first example of sectarian violence we've seen in Syria over the past few months. What do you make of it?
Yeah, of course, back in March, we saw those attacks against the Alawite minority, the sect that former President Bashar al-Assad and his family came from, reprisal attacks that resulted in hundreds of people being killed. And the Druze would have been watching that anxiously. There's about a million of them living across the Levant, mostly across Syria, Lebanon, and in Israel, as well as the occupied Golan Heights. And when HTS, the militant group that toppled the Assad regime, came to power late last year, they promised they were going to govern for all Syrians. The sanction relief that they've been given in the months following was sort of largely dependent on that. I mean, thinking back to the EU lifting the bulk of its sanctions, they were pretty clear if religious minorities, if minority sects were targeted, they could roll back that sanction relief. HTS, the leaders of this interim government, want to integrate all the militias that fought in the civil war, all the militias around the country, into its national army now. But the Druze have been very divided over what the right path is for them. They're anxious they're not going to be represented. So many of them have been resisting and pushing back against government forces, having a presence in their southern cities and turning towards their own Druze militias instead. So to give you an idea of the level of mistrust that's out there at the moment, on Tuesday, Druze spiritual spiritual leaders called on those militias to cease fire, lay down their arms and allow the government forces into Ceuta. Then shortly after, one of those leaders said that Damascus had forced them to make that statement and had broken the ceasefire anyway. So the fear, I guess, in Ceuta right now is that Damascus is using these clashes as an excuse to finally gain control over this area that it so far hasn't been able to consolidate its power in.
Yeah, and the other aspect of all of this is Israel's intervention. So after first striking Syrian forces as they entered Ceuta, the IDF's attacks have now spread to the capital Damascus as well, where there's been massive strikes targeting the entrance of the state military headquarters as well as near the presidential palace.
Yeah, Israel has a pretty unique relationship with the Druze. Mm. They make up about half of the occupied Golan Heights. Some have taken up Israeli citizenship, and unlike other Arab citizens of Israel, the Druze living in Israel do have to do mandatory military service in the IDF, and many of them have risen to senior ranks in the military as well. So Israel is saying this intervention in Syria is all about protecting the Druze, right? Protecting this valued part of its community. But not all Druze are welcoming that. Some have told the media that they resent Israel using them as an excuse to justify these military actions. Mm. We know, on the other hand, that Israel's also been very wary of this new Syrian government. It says it doesn't want militants near its borders. But this interim government in Syria says that that's not for Israel to decide, that this is a violation of Syrian sovereignty. Mm. And we heard the UN expressing similar concerns earlier too. The other thing is, if this new government does allow the Druze to resist its calls to integrate, then they fear it's going to set a precedent for other minorities, right? They're still working on a plan to integrate Kurdish forces into the Syrian National Army, for example. So it's going to be hard to sell this situation where there's different rules for different militias and different sects.
And Syria's interim government says 30 people have been killed in all of this, but other groups are putting the number much higher. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is a monitoring group based in the UK, says the death toll is now above 300. The violence is still ongoing, of course, so those numbers are likely to keep rising. And this comes after the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio did initially appear confident, posting on X on Wednesday night that the violence would end within hours. This, of course, has not eventuated. We've also got a lot happening in the occupied West Bank this week, where the UN's Human Rights Office is sounding the alarm over a recent surge in settler violence. So reports we've seen in the past week alone include two Palestinians killed in the territory's north, including a 20-year-old dual US citizen born in Florida, who the Palestinian Health Ministry says was beaten to death. And just before that, there were multiple attacks around the village of Taibeh. This is the only remaining entirely Christian village in the West Bank, and locals say settlers set fires near their church and to multiple homes.
Yeah, and those Taibeh attacks really did draw a lot of international attention. Just on Monday, we had delegates from more than 20 countries visiting the village, along with the Greek Orthodox Patriarch, who called out Israel for failing to respond to calls for help from those Palestinian communities during those attacks. Mm. There's also been some interesting reaction to the other attack you mentioned, where a dual US citizen was reportedly beaten to death by settlers. Mm. The US ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, who's an ardent supporter of Israel and previously went on the record saying there was, quote, no such thing as a Palestinian, has come out very strongly against this incident. He called his killing a, quote, terrorist act and demanded that Israel investigate it aggressively. So it's a huge shift in language from Huckabee, and it's believed to be the first time he's ever actually made a statement on settler violence at all, let alone such a strong one. Whether that represents any real change in the US's stance on the West Bank is still unclear, but I think it does add to the sense that the scale of the violence we're now seeing is getting really difficult to ignore, even for Israel's closest allies. I mean, some of what the UN has said, there's been 100 people wounded in settler attacks through the month of June. That would be the highest monthly figure in two decades.
Yeah, we've spoken before about how violence in the West Bank has been surging since October 7, 2023. And from what the UN is reporting, it really seems to be entering another new phase yet again. Mm. So something to keep an eye on as our focus continues to be on the war in Gaza.
Australia values our relationship with China and will continue to approach it in a calm and consistent manner, guided by our national interest and indeed in the interests of the region as well.
A commitment to equal treatment to seeking common ground while sharing differences, pursuing mutually beneficial cooperation, serves the fundamental interests of our two countries and two peoples.
From the Middle East to Asia now, and Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has wrapped up his six-day tour of China with scenic walks, tourism deals and a spot of panda diplomacy. It also, of course, included a critical high-level meeting with the President Xi Jinping, a snippet of which you just heard there. SBS Chief Political Correspondent Anna Henderson has been covering the visit and joins us on the pod all the way from Chengdu. Anna, welcome back. China is Australia's biggest trading partner, but with regional security concerns constantly at play, how do you think the PM has gone walking this very tricky economic and defence tightrope?
Well, good afternoon, Kat and Claudia, from a very sweaty Chengdu here in China. It's hard to firstly just underestimate the temperature. I think it's about 37 degrees here at the moment, but when I look it up, it says it feels like 46 degrees. So I don't know how those giant pandas are faring in this heat. Apparently, even though they are covered in that very rich fur, they are able to withstand it. I'm not having as good a time doing that. But amongst the realities of reporting in this environment, the security concerns have been certainly raised. The Prime Minister confirmed that in his meeting with President Xi, he did raise his concerns about the Chinese warships circumnavigating Australia. And they didn't just circumnavigate, remember, they also conducted a live firing exercise. And the opposition has been furious about the way Labor's handled this, because their claim is that this live firing exercise was actually doing essentially a dummy exercise of actually attacking an Australian city. So the question remains in terms of how the Prime Minister has managed this process as to whether or not he was strong enough. And we don't know the answer to that question because we weren't in the room, but it's quite clear from how Anthony Albanese has discussed the meeting in press conferences that he wants to leave the impression that there was no assurance given by President Xi that these exercises wouldn't continue. What Anthony Albanese said is that both countries are going to conduct maritime activities and if they're not breaking international law, that will continue.
Tell us about that tense moment we saw earlier in the week when the Australian press pack, including yourself, was surrounded by Chinese security. What have the realities been of trying to report freely in Beijing?
This was in some ways not surprising, but it still was a real moment of, I think, genuine worry amongst the television reporters who were all of us together reporting on the Prime Minister's trip at the Drum and Bell Tower area in Beijing. We were away from the sort of main fray. We were away from the Prime Minister, but we were with a diplomatic entourage. We went to film there and immediately the local security guards started to raise concerns about why we were there. They went on to tell us that we couldn't leave, that they had called the police and that we would now have to delete any footage we'd recorded there, which was not really any footage that was controversial, I guess, but it was something that they were extremely worried about us doing. They didn't think that we had the right permissions to be at that particular location. And it was our diplomatic entourage who managed to encourage us to return to the bus we were leaving on. And suggested that we quite quickly remove ourselves from that situation. We all, of course, were carrying both our passports and English language and Mandarin permission to be there, but in the end it just wasn't considered enough. So we're encircled by that group of local security officials. We were told we couldn't leave, but once the bus arrived and we started to file onto that bus, they didn't physically stop us from leaving and we were able to depart. And I can confirm that I understand that Australia has raised this incident at a very high level with the Chinese authorities and has really raised questions about why that action was taken against us. In the end, no footage was deleted and we were able to leave. But it was a really stark reminder of just how significant the crackdown is on reporting here and how hard it is to do free and fair reporting under those conditions, even if we're travelling on the invitation of the Chinese Premier with our Prime Minister.
And if listeners missed Wednesday night's World News Bulletin, you were reporting from the most amazing spot on the Great Wall of China. The Prime Minister was seen getting his steps up behind you. How much of this trip has been about soft diplomacy?
Okay, so firstly, on the Great Wall of China, you probably both recall that the Prime Minister also has gone to the Kokoda track with the PNG leader James Marape and walked the Kokoda track, or at least part of it, with his counterpart there. And again here, you know, travelling to the Great Wall of China in particular, sort of walking in the steps of previous Labor leaders who've had a very, largely important connection with China over many years. It really was part of the Prime Minister's diplomatic process, which is to respect other cultures, to take the time to understand them, to be careful in how he interacts, and to not take other cultures and the way that other countries operate for granted. This is really his mode of operating at the moment, and it does take time, and it does invite some criticism. The question of why we were in China for five, including travel time, 7 days. That's a really significant period of time to be out of the country. But I would suggest that the Prime Minister wanted to have a full schedule. He wanted to go to different parts of China. President Xi has come to, I think, every state and territory, or at least all the states in Australia. And there was a view that the Prime Minister needed to show his own goodwill to the idea that, you know, when foreign leaders want to do deals with other countries, want to be economically tied to other countries, want to understand other countries, this is really important. And the other aspect of the relationship, which is critical, is that if you already have a pretty good foundation of the relationship, that the lines of communication are open, the idea that there could be a misunderstanding or a misstep in terms of something happening militarily in the Indo-Pacific is lessened, because if there is a live firing exercise, or if there is a Chinese military interaction with Australia, the hope is that because there's respect in the relationship, those issues can be dealt with quickly and they won't be left in a situation where that could lead to a misunderstanding, which could then be escalated to something far more serious across the region.
Anna, thank you so much for taking some time out of that very busy trip to join us on the pod this week.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
A major data breach, a super injunction, a secret route that has already cost hundreds of millions of pounds. Ministers who served under the party opposite have serious questions to answer about how this was ever allowed to happen.
Details of a secret plan by the UK government to resettle thousands of Afghans in Britain have been made public. It was a plan enacted in April 2024 after the previous UK government learned of a massive data breach that occurred in February 2022, where the details of nearly 19,000 people who had applied to move to the UK after the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan were leaked by a UK Special Forces official. They were not told at the time that their personal info had been leaked, but the UK government set up the Afghanistan response route to relocate those affected. The information included contact details and, in some cases, family information of people who were associated with or had helped British forces in Afghanistan before they, of course, withdrew from the country in 2021, and who, as a result, confronted a serious safety risk from Taliban reprisal. The previous government learned of the leak after some of the details appeared on Facebook, and so far some 4,500 Afghans affected have arrived in the UK. The High Court judgment was made public on Tuesday, Justice Chamberlain saying it was quite possible some Taliban infiltrators did see parts of the leaked document in the Facebook group.
Yeah, the reason we're only finding out about this just now is because the courts have only just lifted the super injunction they put in place about 600 days ago to prevent the media reporting on this. Unlike regular injunctions, super injunctions injunctions not only prevent the disclosure of information, but also the disclosure of the injunction, the order's existence itself, by anyone. So these have been used by massive corporations in the past and even celebrities to sort of protect details of their private lives, but they've very rarely been used by governments. All of this happened under the previous Conservative government, which is why we heard Keir Starmer, the current PM, come out so strongly against it. Mm. Back then, about 600 days ago when it happened, the Ministry of Defence asked the court for a regular injunction, but it was actually the judge who decided to upgrade it to that super injunction, reasoning that thousands of lives could be at risk if these names, if this list of names, made its way to the Taliban. I mean, if you think back to 2021 and the level of fear that there was among Afghans who had worked with Western governments about what might happen to them now that they would be living under Taliban control once again. I mean, you remember the pictures of coming out of Kabul airport, of people chasing after those American planes, just desperate to get out, clinging to the wings, fearing what was going to happen. That was the level of fear. But almost immediately, when this super injunction was put in place, questions started to be raised over the implications of it. Another judge, who you mentioned, Justice Chamberlain, who was appointed to regularly review it, pointed out it was kind of the first of its kind, and it raised issues around freedom of speech. He almost had it lifted last year, but his decision was ultimately overturned on appeal. Mm. The other issue is the cost that's come as a result of this. So this relocation effort that came about as a result of this leak has already cost the UK government £400 million, and they expect to spend another £450 million on it as they continue the relocation effort. So the judge who did try to get this lifted, Justice Chamberlain, argued it was fundamentally objectionable for decisions involving such huge amounts of public funds to be used in circumstances where those decisions are completely shielded from public debate.
Mm, and we obviously heard Keir Starmer speaking just before, but Defence Secretary John Healey has since apologised as well to those affected by the leak, addressing the House of Commons, saying it was a result of a spreadsheet being emailed outside of authorised government systems, so quite shocking, and described it as a serious departmental error. Healey said it was actually one of many data losses during the Afghanistan evacuation, the names of MPs, senior military officers revealed also in separate breaches. Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch apologised on behalf of her party, saying, "Somebody made a terrible mistake and we are sorry for that." And Shadow Defence Secretary James Cartledge, who was in government when the secret scheme was established, said the data leak should never have happened and was an unacceptable breach of all relevant data protocols. The Metropolitan Police, however, have decided an investigation is unnecessary. The July 16 deadline for Tuvalu nationals to apply for the world's first climate visa is here, and more than a third of the Polynesian island's population have put their name on the ballot. Under the deal, 280 people will be randomly selected every year for permanent residency status in Australia.
Yeah, the groundbreaking Falapeli Union was inked in 2024, part of Canberra's efforts to limit China's expanding influence in the region. While the visa has been hailed as a landmark response to climate-forced migration, it's also fueled concerns that nations like Tuvalu could be rapidly drained of skilled professionals and critical labour.
Only a short distance away, and while New Caledonia has not been promised its much sought after independence, it could have its own state and nationality under a proposal by France. French President Emmanuel Macron announced the agreement after 10 days of negotiations, following months of civil unrest that you might recall broke out in May last year after Paris planned to give voting rights to thousands of non-Indigenous residents, stirring controversy among the Indigenous Kanak population.
Yeah, but this proposal certainly has a long way to go before it can take effect, with a referendum scheduled for February for the New Caledonian public to vote on. Alongside statehood, the agreement includes allowing New Caledonian residents to vote after 10 years of living on the island, as well as a renewal of the territory's nickel processing capabilities, with some contention over where the reserves will be sold as France looks to impose limits within the EU.
And finally, in South America, the Peruvian president's visit to the city of Iquitos has been met with protest. Workers and union groups began mobilising early in the morning, approaching the venue where President Dina Boluarte, who has a historically low approval rating of just 2%, was scheduled to attend a regional council meeting.
Police responded with tear gas while protesters threw objects and firecrackers. Demonstrators are angered by what they describe as Boluarte's inaction to improve the economy or fight crime. And earlier this month, she caused upset after she doubled her salary.
Okay, to wrap up this week, we've got a bit of a weird one out of Cameroon where the world's oldest president has just announced his intention to run for an eighth consecutive term. Paul Biya is already 92 years old, and if he wins the upcoming vote in October, that would make him 99 by the next election. A 99-year-old president, Claudia. I feel old. I'm 28 and I feel old. How? How is this possible?
I don't know if it's what I would want to be doing at 99, but each to their own, I guess. I mean, Joe Biden was copping a lot of flack at last year's election.
He's making him look young, chicken.
In his 70s. I mean, he still has a couple decades left.
Exactly.
Like all good decisions, Kat, Bia announced his re-election bid on X, saying it came after, quote, numerous and insistent calls from all over the country for him to run again. But there's also been plenty of calls for him to step aside and let someone younger do the job. He's been in power for 43 years now.
Wow.
And he's faced pretty steady allegations of corruption in that time. He also went missing for about 6 weeks last year, so there were a lot of questions about his health.
Yeah, that's not ideal for a president to just disappear for 6 weeks. But also, him using X, maybe he's more young and sprightly than we're giving him credit for.
He's speaking to the youth, for
exactly,
sure.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's the world this week. Remember, be sure to like and subscribe if you're enjoying the pod, and drop us a little note of what you'd like to hear more of. See you next time, Claudia.
Can't wait.